Okay, great. Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to present some results here that we have obtained. And also, I want to thank very much to be invited to come here. It's been a great workshop, and I'm looking forward for the next few weeks because it's going to be just really interesting. Anyway, so I want to talk about some modeling that we've done in order with the aim to get some insight as to what the cortical effect on the olfactory bulb could be, and what we're looking at the network structure in the bulb. We're trying to come up with models that would give insight into that, and how that would then affect the odor discrimination that the animal would do it, well, in our little model. So this work was started with my graduate students, Yufei Zhao, and then the bulk of the work was actually done with these four undergraduates, Rayne Adams, James Graham, and Hugen Han, and Tom Zhao. And that's the work I will present here. Good. Okay, so you'll remember, like, actually, first day, we got a very nice introduction to, you know, that there are smells which are innate, like, for instance, the smell of the major urinary protein, which really the mouse can't help but male mouse can't help just becoming aggressive when it smells that smell, and that's it. On the other hand, there are smells for which the response is flexible, as in the meaning of that smell is not fixed, and so it needs to be learned. And so that could depend on history, or it could also depend on the context or the task that the animal is pursuing at a certain time. And so that's what we're interested in particular, because so you have to process these odors then differently depending on the task. And that information about that task can come, for instance, from other brain areas, from top-down projections. And just to illustrate what we have in mind, I want to just briefly discuss these really nice results from the Gilbert lab in visual cortex. What they find, they look at a single neuron, which is a receptive field here, so this is the visual field that presents a picture like that. And the receptive field is like, just like this. And so this neuron has a certain preferred orientation. And the response, however, of that neuron depends very strongly on a number of effects. It depends on whether the animal is awake. No, I didn't say it right. It depends on the picture much further away from its receptive field, and in particular, depends on the fact whether this bar is part of an extended contour or not. And that dependence, however, is only there if the animal is awake, which suggests that it's some kind of a top-down input, and the animal previously has had to learn contour task. It has to have done some contour task before. And also that response then, this enhanced response in a situation like that only occurs if the current task is a contour task. And so the picture that emerged from that or suggested is that during this learning of the contour task, this perceptual learning, there are lateral connections established in the visual cortex, which later then enable the top-down projections to make use of those connections to elicit different response depending on what the overall picture is. And so that's the kind of picture we have in mind. We're wondering whether something like that would also be going on in the olfactory system. And just to pick up on these different centrifugal inputs that could come in there, like Steve Shi discussed, there could be neuromodulatory inputs like noradrenaline coming from locus coeruleus, which are typically kind of slow and affect broadly all neurons of a specific type. Or the other inputs, which are glutamatergic, and they typically are faster, and particularly they're specific to specific neurons, not just a specific neuron type. And so here is shown, just to remind you of what you know, there's this substantial projection from the piriform cortex to the olfactory bulb, and in particular to the granule cell layer. Here you see the staining here. The projections are all into the granule cell layer and not in the other layers. And so that's sort of, these are glutamatergic projections onto granule cells. And so that, of course, begs the question, what could be the purpose of that? And so there are two questions that are connected is, well, if these projections are specific, then of course the connectivity that is established will be central to whatever that function could be. And then once you have a connectivity, well, what could you actually achieve with that kind of connectivity? The other aspect that's really nice about the system, in the olfactory system, is that there's extensive plasticity going on even in adult animals. So there's synaptic plasticity, and there's also spine turnover. I'll mention it a little bit later again. And in particular, what I'll focus on is there's even in adult animals, you have this turnover of granule cells with new neurons coming in and other ones going away, which gives you restructuring of the network under control of stimuli, because all this depends on the stimulation. Okay, so Of course, I don't have to tell you about the olfactory system anymore. That's just one aspect I want to add, because that's sort of the motivating factor in the back of our minds is, so what is the, coarsely speaking, the role of the olfactory bulb? So we were motivated actually by these pretty old results by now in zebrafish and for Friedrich and Laurent. Well, they measured, of course, they measured the input patterns. So these are glomerular patterns in a zebrafish in response to different amino acids, which are just like in the mouse, sort of complex patterns, which have some kind of a chemotopic arrangement, but not very clear. But they're complex patterns. That's the most important part. And they followed them in time, and they showed that the output patterns, they followed in time. And so they showed that while initially, when you present the odor, you have a high correlation between these different patterns. Here are correlations between different amino acid patterns. Whereas later in time, these correlations decrease substantially. And so it was suggested that maybe what the olfactory bulb does, among other things, is to kind of decorrelate these patterns or change the odor representation so they're more different, which would make sense because it probably would be easier to discriminate them later and would store them later and so on. So it kind of made sense and would also be in, what you expect in other sensory areas, like in the retina, you have a contrast enhancement. So it's sort of this idea. Now the question is, how could you achieve that? How could the olfactory bulb achieve that if these patterns are relatively complex? So one suggestion is, well, these are so complex that you can't really deal with that complexity. And so Tom Cleland suggested that you have actually just so in each channel by itself is transformed non-linearly, and that will enhance the contrast by making use of the fact that the periglomerular cells are activated first and give feed-forward inhibition on the mitral cells, and then therefore the mitral cells respond later, but then they have a larger dynamic range to code for, and so the patterns become more different. If you have these model patterns like that, this would be the input and output. It looks like that. They're easier to discriminate. So that's one way. Another way that was discussed was Martin Wiechelt, who said, well, if the patterns are complex, well, complex is about the same as random. He wouldn't use those words. He's a real mathematician, but, you know, so that's sort of the idea. And so maybe a random connectivity would also work to perform this decorrelation. And he showed very elegantly that if you just have a thresholding device, just a rectifier and run, and then feed, which decorrelates the patterns already just by making it sparser, and if you feed that back in this recurrent connectivity, you get actually substantial decorrelation and recapitulate quite nicely this, the experimental decorrelation of the network. Okay, so we're having a different perspective here. We're thinking of these networks actually learning through these connectivities in an adaptive fashion, given the fact that there's so much plasticity in the system. So as I said, we're actually interested in the olfactory bulb providing information to the periform cortex and then getting information back. So I need to put in something in the model about the periform cortex, and that will be also relatively minimal. I'll only use the observation by Don Wilson's lab that the periform cortex has kind of associative properties based on these strong associative fibers laterally. Okay, so we want to implement a model which gives that feedback and then find out what this would do. So I need to tell you a little bit about plasticity, which focuses mostly on the granule cells. So as mentioned before, so the granule cells connect in a reciprocal synapse to the mitral cells. So the mitral cells have an excitation to the granule cell, which then directly gives inhibition back. That will be important for the whole modeling. And in addition, the granule cell gets these inputs from cortex, and both these excitatory synapses are plastic. In addition, these spines here are highly fluctuating and become stabilized with activity. So that's another source of plasticity. But the most important one we want to look at here is that these granules are actually turned over all the time, meaning you have about 50,000 coming in every day, but only half of them actually make it. And so the whole network structure changes all the time. And importantly, this plasticity depends on external factors. It depends on odor enrichment or deprivation. So the more odor you provide, if you enrich the odor, you have actually higher, more granule cells survive. And if you enhance the excitability of the individual granule cells genetically by putting another sodium channel in, then you also enhance the survival of these cells. And the survival is odor specific. So, I forgot to show them. So if you really deprive the poor mouse of the odor in one nostril, the whole olfactory bulb actually shrinks. And so the survival is order specific. So if you look at the cells that survive, if you how much they respond to a certain stimulation, if you enrich with this combination of odors, then and ask whether they respond to that odor, they have a much higher fraction of cells responding than if you ask whether these surviving cells respond to an odor that had not been enriched in the enrichment. The point is, this enrichment is really specific. The survival is specific to the odors. So a minimal model that you would sort of could extract from that is that you simply say, well, the granule cell survives if it's sufficiently active across some ensemble of odors that it's learning. So that's sort of this minimal approach that we're taking. So then we want to know about what this could have to do with any kind of behavior or performance of the network. And so I want to mention these really nice experiments from the Mardero group. Well, they show this connection between neurogenesis and odor discrimination, so which is based on what was mentioned earlier on this spontaneous discrimination via habituation, where the mouse gets bored when it gets the same odor multiple times. And so that's how you can tell the mouse if then it gets a new odor, that it will suddenly investigate that longer. And so therefore you can tell whether the mouse discriminates this odor without having to give any reward. And the particular advantage in this context is that it was shown that, or strongly indicated, that this learning, this process is actually has a strong component in the olfactory bulb, so you don't have to invoke all kind of other learning centers. The final step that we need to put in here, why we are interested in this part, is that this I forgot to mention one thing. So they can spontaneously discriminate odors. But if you now give two odors which are very similar, they don't spontaneously discriminate them. But they showed that if you then present one of those odors over a period of 10 days, you know, every day for an hour, then after 10 days, they actually do discriminate spontaneously those two odors. However, if you suppress neurogenesis, then this learning does not happen. That's shown here. You know, with normally after 10 days, they do discriminate. With neurogenesis suppressed, they don't. So this suggests that this neurogenesis allows a restructuring of the bulb structure such that the odor representation in the bulb is sort of more, allows an easier readout and therefore enhance the discriminability of those odors. Okay, so now comes the math part. I'm almost embarrassed. It's extremely simple modeling. So, you know, of course, what you really should do is you should think about the biophysics of this neurogenesis survival, all these pathways and stuff like that. None of that is done here. Then you have all the dynamics of the granule cells and mitral cells in the bulb, and none of that is really done. What we really do is just an extremely minimal model, where we only take the mitral cells and the granule cells and cortical cells, and describe each simply by in terms of a rate model. Okay, so that's already stretching things, but that's what we're doing. And so the mitral cells are driven by stimuli. They have some spontaneous activity. They get inhibited by granule cells, and here's the connectivity between these two. And the granule cells are driven by the mitral cells, and importantly, this reciprocal connectivity makes these matrices transpose of each other, and the granule cells get cortical input, and the cortical cells have lateral interactions, giving the associating features. The most important part, these association fibers in a Hebbian fashion. The most important part is this neurogenesis, where we randomly, at each step, add a couple of granule cells, test whether they respond in that network to a given odor ensemble. So the odor ensemble is, you know, some odor ensemble. We test the activity of those granule cells, and if they surpass a certain threshold, G min, then we add to the resilience of those cells. And so they sort of make up resilience. And if the resilience is large enough, they survive according to some survival probability. So that's the whole algorithm for the network evolution. And then what we want to see is how this network then performs. Yes? I didn't say that well enough. No, this DW is actually only cortical. And this is actually just because I want to have memory, be able to store a memory in there. That's really all I need from there. Okay. So now as we've, there were the beautiful talks by Dima and Kevin yesterday about the readout in the piriform cortex. And we need, in order to see what the network actually does, whether it discriminates odor, we need to know what is the readout. So we should do some readout, you know, fancy readout like that, and we have not done that yet. So we take a much more simple picture, which is going back sort of this old framework of you just take this activity pattern and look at this activity pattern as such, no timing information. But I think some of our interesting results will carry over if you have this primacy coding, but I'm not there yet. Okay, so we have these activity patterns, and so the discriminability is limited by, well, these are mean rates, but of course in any given window that you measure this number of spikes, that number of spikes will fluctuate, and so any odor precipitation will actually generate some kind of a cloud, and you will have a hard time discriminating these odors if those clouds overlap. And so what we do is we assess the discriminability simply by looking at the difference of the means relative to these variances. So you look at this Fischer discriminant and pick, we look at this Fischer discriminant. And now, of course, we don't have any variance because we just have this rate model, right? And so we just make that additional daring step is that we say, well, maybe these neurons fire Poisson-like, which of course they don't really do in the bulb. And we are currently working on recurrent networks that are spiking. We want to know what their spiking statistics or spiking behavior is. But right now, we just assume these are Poisson spiking. And so then the variance, of course, is simply given by the means. And I get a very simple assessment of how easy it is to discriminate these odors. I just have to look at different of the mean squared relative to what the overall activity is. So how well do these networks do? Let's just look at very simple cases which are also helpful for assessing the later cases. So if you only have this hypothetical situation that each mitral cell drives one granule cell and gets inhibition back from one granule cell, then what the only thing that happens is that an input pattern like this is simply scaled down. And if it's scaled down, then the difference shrinks, the denominator shrinks, but overall the official discriminant goes down because of the square. And so the discriminability just gets worse and worse. So that kind of network would never do any good. And so indeed, as you increase the inhibition strength here by reducing the threshold for survival, you know, the survival of granule cells depends on this threshold. If that threshold is low, lots of granule cells will survive, inhibition will be strong, and so the performance just gets worse and worse. So that's not very interesting, but we need that for later. The other extreme is if you have an all-to-all connectivity, then what you have is that each mitral cell gets the same kind of inhibition, so all these activities are simply shifted down. So that's good because the overall activity is smaller, the denominator is smaller, but the difference between the patterns remains the same, and so this Fischer discrimination actually goes up. Indeed, but it has a limit because at some point the rates go negative when you lose the information about these differences completely because the cells are silent. And so that's what you see as you increase the inhibition. First, the official discriminant goes up and then goes down. Okay, so this is just as reference points. So what we really would like to have is, you know, we want to see what our network does. And what we'd like to have is that, oh, I should go back here, sorry. We don't want to have inhibition here, but we want to have inhibition here. So if you now have this learning algorithm where the granule cell survives, if it's sufficiently active, that means if it's driven by this mitral cell and this mitral cell, then it will establish through the reciprocal synapse inhibition between these two. So it establishes inhibition between coactive mitral cells. And so you get a connectivity. If you have these stimuli as learning ensemble, get stimuli connectivities like this, that this mitral cell, these mitral cells inhibit these mitral cells, meaning these inhibit each other and these inhibit each other. And indeed, in that case, the performance is much better. You have suppression here, but not here, and you have substantially better performance. Okay, good. So this has nothing to do with cortex. This was just sort of how this such networks would enhance discrimination based on this assessment via the official discriminant. But I think it already, I think it matches nicely this picture that, you know, matches the experiment that when you expose the system, like in this simple model here, to the odors that are to be discriminated, the network rearranges, generates these kind of connectivities, increases the difference between the patterns, and therefore the spontaneous discrimination, the perceptual learning of discrimination is achieved. So I think it matches the Mandelbrot experiments. So once you put the cortex in, then you can also learn, I want to have not two stimuli for illustration purposes. I learn both of them in the bulb, but only one of them in the cortex, so I can compare what the cortex would do for the discrimination. And you see in this case, with cortex, with this memory, the performance is somewhat better, significantly better. And more importantly to observe is here that you have now established a connectivity where from these, the cortical cells corresponding to these, I should say, the connectivity is set up for illustration purpose such that each mitral cell drives exactly one cortical cell, which of course not real, but otherwise you can't illustrate what's going on. So it's always one-to-one. So these, excuse me, these cortical cells correspond to these mitral cells, and they would inhibit these mitral cells, but they don't because there are no granule cells. But here, they inhibit, I didn't show that right, sorry, the arrow misled me. These cortical cells correspond to these cells, and they inhibit these mitral cells, which also correspond to these cells. That's this connectivity. So you establish a specific inhibition back there. I mentioned this threshold that in a given odor presentation, the model requires that the granule activity has to be above a certain threshold. I mean, the idea being that for the cell to survive, it probably some pathway has to be driven that protects it then from some death signal that actually comes during sleep from the cortex. And so that pathway probably needs some sufficient activity. And so if we don't put that threshold in, the discrimination ability is actually very similar, but the connectivity you get is quite different. And that's important to note. If you don't have that threshold, then a granule cell can survive if it gets in one odor driven here, in another driven here, and so it makes connections between mitral cells that were never coactive and they have nothing to do with the stimuli. So a connectivity like that is not really useful if you want to drive some specific patterns. So that's what's generated here, that now these cortical cells that correspond to this left stimulus, they not only inhibit the left mitral cells, but also this right pair of mitral cells. And so that's really not a good connectivity. So in the following, I will always consider a significantly large threshold for that survival, so I get clean connectivities like that. And so the picture then is like this, if you learn two stimulus pairs, when also memorize them in cortex, you get connectivities that these cortical cells inhibit specifically these mitral cells through the granule cells, which are not shown, and these cortical cells specifically inhibit these mitral cells, and that all goes through this reciprocal synapse that plays an essential role here. Because again, the granule cell survives is sufficiently active, so it survives if this mitral cell and this cortical cell and this mitral cell are all active. But how does the inhibition come out of that? Only because this synapse is reciprocal. That's how this cortical cell then inhibits the mitral cells that actually drive it. And so what this establishes now is a bidirectional connection between the odor representation in the bulb and the odor representation in the cortex. And you have a projection from the bulb to the cortex, but also back again from the cortical representation back to the bulb. So what does that do for you? Yes, please.
So just the way you're presenting it, to me it seems like it's very important that if there's an M to G connection that there has to be G to M.
Yes.
You can imagine if it doesn't, then you're just sort of ticking granule cells coincidentally, but they aren't going to be
influenced. Right, right.
Is that a strict requirement?
It's not exactly strict if you lose it somewhat, things get worse. It doesn't instantly collide. But if you really had, like, this mitral cell drives this granule cell, but this granule cell drives then some random other mitral cell, you just sort of get no good, it's just not a good connectivity. Okay, so the model suggests that you generate, you generate these subnetworks. And so this would also mean if you now eliminate one of those memories, that you probably would lose specifically these granule cells because they're not driven anymore, and so they don't survive. And so in the model, of course, that pans out because it's a very simple construct. So if you first learn these odors in cortex and you quench one of those memories, the number of granule cells decreases substantially. And the kind of granule cells they are, that's the ones that were actually responding to odor 3, which had been encoded in this memory. And then the discrimination also gets worse because you don't have that input from cortex anymore that helped you discriminate this odor pair. So is that related to anything in the real world? Yeah, indeed. Actually, it recapitulates earlier experiments, again, from the Mandel-Rodiguier group, where they did these really nice experiments. What they had is they had first learned the mouse for a week an odor task, associated one odor with the reward. And then the second week, they gave a visual task. The reward was now associated with some visual cue, but the odor was just not there. Okay, so they remembered actually when they then came back to the older task, the mice did remember that older task and did just fine. Good. So in the second set, they did again an older task and then a visual task, but during the visual task, they randomly associated the previously learned odor with either a reward or not a reward, which means the odor really had now no meaning anymore, clearly. And so what happened is first, they didn't remember the task anymore when it came back. Well, that makes a lot of sense. But interestingly, there was a large number of granule cells that actually died. And the cells that died were preferentially those that actually had been responding to that odor. So this matches pretty much what the model shows. And it's again, strongly suggests that you have these subnetworks that go where the granule cells place, or they're associated with certain odors associated with the cortical memory and then with the bulbar representation. OK, so now what could this achieve? You know, what could this achieve? Well, so, I mean, what could the cortex do that the bulb couldn't do by itself? I mean, so it must be something that it collects information that the bulb doesn't have, or something else that doesn't happen is, you know, this restructuring of the network in the bulb actually takes quite a while. Because one limiting factor, for instance, is, I mean, this granule cell has synapses coming from cortex and synapses coming from mitral cells, but they don't come at the same time. There's about 2 or 3 days in between. So that means to really establish this connection, you need to wait about, you know, a number of days. You just can't do that faster than a few days. And so the bulb structure cannot change faster than, you know, an order of days. Whereas in the cortex, the changing the weights of the synapses that are already there can be done on a much faster time scale. So if you imagine now the following experiment, where you learn two odor pairs, like that, store them in memory. So you learn them in cortex, they're really important, that's why you store them in cortex. And the bulb also develops a nice clean connectivity like that. So now this pair, the odors in this pair can be discriminated nicely, and these also. However, the task is not discriminating these odors. We're actually now asking for discriminating this mixture. So you make now a compound odor object where the red and the black mixture have to be discriminated. Now, to enhance the discrimination of these kind of odors, what you need is inhibition between these kind of mitral cells and these kind of mitral cells. But there is no such inhibition because they were never activated previously at the same time. There's only connectivity between the first, within the first pair, within the second part, but not really between the, across the pairs. So in fact, if you now present these mixtures, this network does very poorly. The official discrimination goes actually down compared to just the inputs. It's really bad. And it is really bad because what happens is essentially this thing that we just have one effective connection per granule cell is essentially, you think of this as one channel and this as another channel. When you have only connections, that this channel inhibits itself and just scales itself down, and similarly this. However, the cortex could now quickly learn that we're talking about mixtures, and it could make a connectivity, you know, expose now a mixture for a little while, and it could make a connectivity that gives also association between these cortical cells, which correspond to these mitral cells, and these cortical cells, which are these mitral cells. You have this connectivity. And if you then look at the discrimination with the same bulbar connectivity, the bulbar connectivity has not changed because that takes too long, then you actually get substantial better discrimination. It goes up from 0.3 to 0.6. And so that sort of sounds or feels to me similar to like this experiment by Gilbert I mentioned, that you have in the bulb, in this model at least, in the bulb, you would have a set of learned connectivities, which allow, give you sort of like tool, to give cortex the tools to now pick whatever connectivities are relevant for the current task. Okay, in this case, you actually want to combine this connectivity with this, and then that's an odor adaptive, a task adapted procedure. There's one more aspect I want to bring in here. The other thing the cortex also has is information about other, about context. I mean, it gets information about other sensory modi. And so for instance, it gets information about a visual context. That's actually also shown in nice experiments by Modaro group in the following way. What they did is they, again, had these mice sit in their cage, associate an odor, you know, for a week. They could do these experiments for a week, associate the odor with a certain visual kind of environment, which is strong visual cues. And then after a week, they put the mouse in the same cage, but no odor. And they find that the granule cells are actually quite active, even though there's no odor, which shows that there's actually input coming in from someplace else, which must be essentially cortex. And that these context-evoked granular cell patterns are actually correlated with the odor pattern that would have been invoked by the odor that usually was there when the animals were in that cage. And so this tells us that the granule cells actually get information about the context in this environment. And so the question is now, you know, of course we can put that in a model very simply. We just extend our cortex by putting a couple of context cells in there, so to speak. Just others, you know, extend the cortex which gets information from someplace else, and we make associated fibers between those so we can make larger memories. And then we associate these contexts with odors. That's quite straightforward. And the question is, what can you achieve with that? So let me first, this is sort of a, let me first explain the pictures. Again, we take two odor pairs, present those, and the system will learn them. And so in the connectivity in the bulb looks now like a mess. You can't tell these two odor pairs apart. But you associate one pair with one context and the other with another context. So this is your enlarged cortex, where one context is this, are these cells, and these are the other context. And there are connections between this context and these cortical cells, and a connection between this context and these cortical cells. And since you associate the odors with these different contexts, the back projections from cortex to the bulb are actually still specific. They don't show this mess here, so you really have these cortical cells really mostly inhibit the mitral cells associated with this odor pair, which was associated with the second context, and vice versa. So straightforwardly, of course, you know, the granule cells, if you look now at the granule cell response, indeed, okay, they show these correlations with the context as expected. The interesting part is now that if you didn't have that context, this discrimination task would be very hard, and it wouldn't really work very well, because we've chosen it such that in order to discriminate these guys, you want to have a lot of inhibition here, but you don't want to have the inhibition here. However, these cells want to have inhibition here and not here. So if you learn this connectivity, you will generate inhibition here where you don't want it, you generate inhibition here where you don't want it. But in the presence of the context, this is it, the connectivity is sort of chosen, used appropriately to actually increase the performance substantially like that. So now you can actually discriminate these odors much better in the presence of the context, whereas if the context is switched around, if you present in the wrong context, everything goes wrong. I mean, so it's this picture that, you know, if you had to smell, discriminate the smells of two wines, if you knew it was a white wine or red wine, it would help you probably discriminate a Chardonnay from a, whatever, Pinot Grigio or something. Anyway, so that's what this model predicts, and gives a picture of what actually could be going on in this overall system when you have that this neurogenesis. I mean, this is, it's an embarrassingly simple model, and there are obvious, a whole bunch of obvious extensions that we need to do, but it predicts these network structure, subnetwork structure, where you have bidirectional connectivity between cortical and bulbar representations, which then induce a couple of different performance improvements, I should say. Well, thank you very much for your attention.
Start by asking you a quick question. So, as I was trying to follow, it struck me that it's not to me very clear whether you couldn't use everything you said with existing granule cells. It's not clear to me.
It's being, why not just use synaptic plasticity? So there's, I sort of, the one answer which I think is reasonable, but I don't think it's the final, it's the full answer, is simply because if you have these complex patterns, and you don't know which patterns you need to deal with. So if you wanted to really use synaptic plasticity, you would have to have the anatomy there to really make who knows what kind of how many connections. But most of those connections would actually be pretty much, if you put synaptic plasticity in, they probably would be downregulated to zero. And a lot of those cells that were connected that way would not be active, and probably you would just then take those out. That makes sense, but it's not the full story. I think important is, that's another extension we have to do, is that because you have the steady influx of granule cells, the system is constantly in a critical period, because each new granule cell has a critical period of when it's 2 to 4 weeks old, and so it always can learn. And after that, because it's all learning during adult, it's not like during development where you have a nice critical period, which is now. You need this critical period all the time. But we haven't done anything on that yet. But I think that's important to do.
So I'm not very clear. So when you the cortical feedback are they specifically to a subset of a granule cell, or you're selecting the connections?
Well, so, well, we don't select them. We just put, each granule cell has a random set of connections. But the system selects those granule cells that are most active. And so that selects granule cells that are connected in a very specific way. So you get a very specific, like here, you get, I mean, I don't show granule cells, but the inhibition between this mitral cell and that mitral cell is done by the number of all these granule cells that are sort of have this right connection.
In terms of cortical feedback.
And similar here, here's the cortical feedback also goes through those very same granule cells. And so these cortical cells drive granule cells, which then inhibit those mitral cells. So they're very specific connections set up that way.
But
was that a question?
Cortical feedback is broadcasting to a very wide region, right?
Well, it the cortical feedback, again, drives granule cells.
Yeah.
And it drives specific granule cells because certain granule cells only survive because only those were active enough. So it's very, very specific, this network that's set up that way.
Can you say more specifically what your objective function is and how you train the network? Is it back propagation? Is it?
No, I'm sorry. I really did a poor job in explaining. It's way simpler than that. It's sort of biophysically motivated, but you can't say any biophysics. It's simply we take a granule cell, connect it randomly with a bunch of mitral cells and cortical cells, and then probe, run the network, present a bunch of odors, and look at which granule cells are active. So that's sort of mimicking or a caricature of what we think is going on, that granule cells that are sufficiently active are protected from this apoptotic signal that comes during slow wave sleep and kills the cells. And that's sort of what we, the caricature of that.
So you've not tried to make the network actively learn something?
No, there's no objective function. It's just whoever is strong will survive. And the nice thing is that, you know, this very simple algorithm makes inhibition between coactive cells, and that's what you need to improve this kind of performance.
I also have a question in this direction. So what's the rate of the generation of these granule cells, or do you replace the dying one with a new one, or how do you?
We constantly add a fixed number, which is sort of reasonable. I mean, I can in the real mouse, the number that's coming in is about fixed. It depends a little bit about on enrichment and stuff like that, but it's essentially just a fixed number that comes in all the time. So the total number of granule cells that we get and that you also get in the mouse is depends on how many actually survive. That's why when you have an enriched environment, you have more granule cells survive. You have a bigger bulb and vice versa. Well, they're robust. I mean, if you have the influx too large, then there will be a lot of granule cells that are randomly connected and haven't been selected out yet, right? So you ideally, you would only want to add one at each time, because then you have only at most one granule cell which is connected badly, but so they have a balance. But it's pretty robust. It's sort of like the more you add, it becomes a little bit more diffuse. The connectivity becomes more diffuse.
So I have a question about the numbers. So it's that
why don't you apply to what?
Numbers. Because numbers. Does it mean like there is much more granule cells than mitral cells?
Yeah.
And then for each granule cell, there is a cortical cells. It should be not, I don't know real anatomy about the piriform cortex. It seems that it could be less neurons into the piriform cortex.
Well, in reality, the piriform cortex has more cells than the mitral cells, right? So you actually have a expansion there. And the granule cells, in reality, are way more than mitral cells, right? And that's what we also have here. I mean, we typically run with a few thousand granule cells and maybe just 50 mitral cells.
Now, if you put the cortical cells to granule cells, and there is much more granule cells,
yeah, but one cortical cell can drive many granule cells.
I have a question about the neurogenesis. In the dentate, the neurogenesis doesn't go on through the entire of life, but it's just really kind of a developmental window, and it decreases. Is that also true for the granule cells and inhibitory?
It's nerve? Also true. It does decrease with age, but it's still, I mean, even, you know, adult means not very old necessarily, but, you know, like a few months old might still have significant neurogenesis, but it does decrease then with age. And
So then the major kindness would be working when the animal is young, and it would work less and less as time went on.
Yeah. I think it's not perfectly clear why that is, but that's the situation. But yeah.
So there's a kind of following question about the numbers. We know that there's much more granule cell than mitral cells, and what's the proportion is, kind of, what's the numbers of newborn granule cells? How strong effect is that, basically? Because we've been asking, maybe we can do everything with existing connectivity, but can you give the numbers if it's, you know, we know that it's about 5 million granule cells, if I'm not mistaken. Are we talking about 1% of replacement? 10% and what? So
well, I mean, so the numbers are roughly basically what I remember, and I always get mice and rats confused, right? So the incoming cells is in the order of 10 to the 4, I mean, 50,000, which is 50,000 out of 5 million is like 1%.
And that
every day.
Explain the behavior. So, and the second following up question, do you know the experiment that if you switch off the neurogenesis, you actually impair the, some discrimination?
Yeah, that was this experiment, right? So when you, I mean, there's different tasks. Depending on the task, it's not so clear. The clearest signal you get when you take this spontaneous discrimination through habituation and the perceptual learning thereof, if you then turn off neurogenesis, you see that usually within a week, they learn to discriminate between plus and minus limonene just fine. But if you block neurogenesis, they don't.
And that explained by 1% of new cells, right? That's the question.
How would we know that it's a person? It's hard to tell, but to answer that question, why 1% is good enough? Most of the cells must be doing nothing, so to speak, for this task.
It's about half a million.
No, I think it's more. I thought it was over a million. I thought it was an order of 5 million, but. I thought it was bigger. It doesn't, I'm not sure it really matters, but I think it was bigger. Because I remember it was a factor of 100 more than what you have mitral cells. You have lots.
Now, maybe one thing to keep in mind, I think, just not to be too cynical, in a very, very, very small fraction of dentate granule cells supposedly do everything in the hippocampus, right?
Right, right,
so,
right.
I think compared to that, we're actually in much better shape. Any more questions?
What do you think would be the key prediction? Would it be the specificity of connectivity between granule cells that get mitral cells?
Right. I mean, so the nice experiment that I've been talking about with Jean-Marie Ladeau is to, so you would, what you would like to do is you would drive cells in the cortex and mark them so that you then can drive them optogenetically, and then you want to see that the granule cells that are then excited are the granule cells that would have been excited by the mitral cell. But that's a tricky experiment because you would have to optically see which granule cells are, so you could look at a simpler experiment, but still hard, would be that you would like to see that if you then drive those peripheral cortex cells, that you get in addition exactly in the mitral cells that you were actually using to drive those peripheral cortex cells, right? It's this loop that you would not establish. But the problem to see the inhibition in the mitral cells, you can't really see it optically, so you have to. Okay. Anyway, so that along these lines, that would be a physiological prediction. And these are then there are these behavioral predictions, which are of course sort of more far-fetched and more loosely connected with what's really going on. This loop is what that would be nice to see. That you have this.
Okay. Of course, we can continue asking Hermann some questions, but let us thank him again. Also, thanks to all the speakers this morning session. Fantastic until lunch. And we'll be back at 2, I believe, and Matthias is going to speak first.